Sunday, the 25th of April, 71.
Those of us who are seriously concerned with living the religious life realize that we have to live in the world but not be of the world. We are well aware that the world constantly batters us with all kinds of trying circumstances, impressions, and situations which are inimical to the living of the religious life. And our tendency is to think in terms of ourselves and of the world. I am one entity, the world is the other entity. And I see the world as something against me, against the realization of living the holy life. Now, we must free ourselves from that illusion. The illusion of the world being separate from me. We call it the external, oneself the internal. But there are not two separate entities, external and internal. Would I be here at all if there were no sun, no earth, no plants, no rocks, no animals, no air, no light, no flowers? Would I be here at all? I exist simply because there is the world, the totality. But I, a human being, like all human beings, who have the capacity to look within myself, because of my ignorance, separate out myself from the world. When, at last, I am free of that ignorance, then I see that the world is myself. I am the world. What society is, I am. What I am, that is what society is. This conflict which we experience, born of separation, has its origins right from our infancy onwards. We are not to blame that we are ignorant in this way. This is how things do happen. Let us just look at it a little bit. And let us also associate it with the whole question of the pleasure drive and the sense pleasures particularly, and self-indulgence lying at the root of it. Let us associate the two together. When I am born, here is this body, a living organism whose very survival depends upon the efficiency with which the pleasure-pain mechanism of the living body will function. If that pleasure-pain mechanism functions somewhat below a necessary minimum, the body will perish. That will be the end. There will be no problem, there will be no attainment, no realization, nothing at all. Now, simply because we do have that minimum sensitivity as far as the pleasure-pain mechanism of the body is concerned, what happens practically from the moment of my birth onwards is that different impressions come upon this body, pleasurable and painful. When I'm suckling away happily at my mother's breasts, I'm happy. When I get a tummy ache or a rumble or whatever it is, I'm unhappy. I may get a tummy ache and I'll yell for my life. Pain. You see? Now, as I grow older, the tendency grows with me to collect, to acquire, to seek the pleasurable sensations, to avoid, to dislike, to fight against the unpleasurable sensations. That is my very beginning. See? So this seeking of pleasure through the senses, first of all through the sense of taste and touch, and then sight and sound and so on. The tendency to seek and acquire these grows and grows, and the tendency to fight against the unpleasant also grows with it. Here is the origin of continuous conflict. Now this, when we say it in so many words, usually makes us feel, yes, that seems to be quite right, all right. And having said that seems to be quite right, we put it out of our minds. Therefore, we don't really learn the deep lessons of that fact of our lives. If we want to learn the deep lessons of that fact of our lives, we must really pay attention to the fact. Just look at it intensely. Sufficiently intensely to make us so aware of the origins of this conflict that much, if not all, of the conflict vanishes. The conflict caused by seeking the pleasurable sensations and trying to avoid, discard, fight against the unpleasurable sensations. Now this is very important to start with. Now once we see this, then where living the religious life is concerned, we no longer have any difficulty in clearly understanding why the great teachers all said, beware of the sense pleasures. We can see, as we are now, that the sense pleasures, the seeking for them, the greed for them, lies at the root of most of our difficulties and troubles. And it is the root of the conflict that lives with us throughout our life. That is one aspect. There is another aspect. a profounder aspect. Now, in order to see into this profounder aspect, let us start by spending just about a minute or a little more in being quiet. Just let the body and the mind be perfectly at ease, utterly restful. Just let it be so. Well, were the body and mind at ease? It is fairly easy for the body to be completely at ease, not so difficult. But what about the mind? What happened actually? Was there or was there not a stream of words passing through the brain with associated images? I'm using the word images not only in the visual sense, but for all the senses. Sounds, tastes, perfumes, etc. Everything. Anything, but mainly a stream of words and a stream of pictures before one's eyes. The sort of quiet that the body can attain, the perfect stillness which the body can have, the brain does not have. There's a stream of words. And if one says that there are no words but a stream of pictures, go a little more deeply into it and see. The fact that you recognize all those pictures, but the recognition is only in terms of the name. Supposing you had pictures of a woodland and a stream. Look, there are words. You recognize this is a woodland. You recognize this is a stream. There are words attached. So that basically, there is this stream of words going through the brain all the time. There is only one circumstance in the life of every human being. And it happens to him practically every day of his life, with very, very rare exceptions. And that is that in deep slumber, in the dreamless slumber, although the brain is active in its own way on its in its own on its own plane, nevertheless, the stream of words has stopped in really profound slumber. And something else. The whole organism is free from the entry, the uprising of desire in any shape or form. That is the desireless state and the thought-free state, which means the sense images free state that occurs in profound slumber. That is why when we wake up, we are recharged with energy. Now, why recharged? What happens? This is something which perhaps scientific research will come to in the years to come. We are recharged because we are in the harmless state. And in that harmless state, we are in complete harmony with the totality. So that the life of the totality fills the organism, makes it whole, heals it. And that harmless state, when the organism is whole, is the experiencing of holiness. So every day of our lives, we do touch holiness. We live in it. But because that is a state which is unconscious, relative to our ordinary waking state, whilst in fact we do come back recharged, revitalized, we cannot utilize that state as we would if we had fully realized our humanness in its purity and in its perfection. Now bear this carefully in mind. The stream of words has stopped, and desire can no longer influence that organism for the time being. If and when, even whilst the body is asleep, words and desire affect the brain, it will record the thing. And you will dream. That is the dream state. And when that also ceases, one wakes up fully in the physical, the ordinary physical waking state. And in the physical waking state, the senses once again operate, and the brain coordinates the operations of the senses and recognizes them by means of this extraordinary faculty which we possess, the faculty of speech, the word. Now you see, it is very important for us who long to live the religious life in the true sense of the word to understand this clearly. Understand it and see it with such intensity that the understanding and the awareness of this truth never leaves us during the waking day. Then you will find that many of the conflicts and the problems that rise up will vanish to start with. Won't vanish altogether, but they will be considerably diminished. And not only that, you will find that the situation around you, the circumstances around you, in a mysterious way, also begin to undergo change for the better, as we say, from the religious point of view. in the harmless state, which is the state of harmony. Now, in this harmless state, which is the state of harmony, the differentiation, the division, I and you, the world and I, the external and the internal, the self and the not self, and this awful division has vanished in the harmless state, the harmonious state. But now, come back to the word and the importance of the word. This stream of words that goes through our mind all day long, the brain chatters away whilst we are awake. What do the words represent?
Would you like to sit there, on that chair, or that one? Would you like to sit cross-legged? All right? And Michael?
Yes, he's all right.
Now, what is this stream of words about? If you spend any time just watching quietly the stream of words that goes through the mind silently, you will find that that stream of words conveys all kinds of sense images and sense impressions. That stream of words also conveys the conflict which, as we saw a few moments ago, arises right from our infancy. The conflict brought about by desiring to possess, to acquire, to experience the pleasurable sensations, to avoid, to fight against and reject the unpleasurable sensations. This is what this stream of words is concerned with. So you see, the part sense pleasures play in producing this conflict. Now, all the world seeks sense pleasures all the time. But the more pleasure we obtain and the more we experience, these impressions sink right down into our whole being. And the impressions all rise up again, clamoring for further food, further experiencing along the same lines. Therefore, one can never be free of this perpetual conflict, this state of evil, completely defeats the religious life. Now, there's another aspect to this. The world, constituted as it is, we, constituted as we are, will always come across the succession of the pleasurable and the unpleasurable, the painful. Today it is a little bit cloudy. Tomorrow it might be brilliant sunshine. The day after it might snow, and so forth. And we will have our reactions to what the world produces and presents to us. Isn't that so? Now, when the pleasurable comes, say you're listening to a wonderful performance of some music. All right, of course it is a pleasurable experience. To live the religious life, one must be fully sensitive to the event as it actually takes place. Now, note very carefully, be fully sensitive to it, fully attentive to it. Then, as the experience proceeds, you live completely in every moment of the experience and die completely to every moment as it sinks into the past. If you die completely to every single moment, you do not acquire, you do not grab, you do not hold. You are free. Associated with this will be the fact that you will retain nothing in the memory in terms of desire to repeat the experience. You will have the purely objective, dispassionate memory that in October 1925 you heard a wonderful performance of such and such a work. That is a purely dispassionate, but there will be no grasping for it, no desire attached to it, that it be repeated. The corpse can't get up and walk. If it did, it would be a frightful affair. So bear that in mind too, carefully. That memory in the form of desire is absent if you are completely sensitive to the pleasurable experience. You don't grasp, therefore. You are unbound by it. You are not bound by it. There is freedom. Now the same applies to the unpleasurable experience. Instead of, if the religious-minded person is free of the folly of fighting against the unpleasurable, but is wholly sensitive to it, then he lives fully and completely through it, and that unpleasurable situation, experience, has done its work in being a lesson for me experiencing that unpleasurable thing. And then there is no aversion towards it in my memory, no desire, no fear lest it may come again, and so on and so on. This way, the soul is free. Utterly free. So the pleasurable and the unpleasurable will of necessity come to all of us, because that is the way the world is. You can't make it different. I can't do anything with the world as such. This is the process of the world. What I can deal with is my understanding of what is happening. And if there is right understanding, there is freedom. So one is free from grasping and desire on the one hand, one is free from aversion and fear and all the rest of it on the other hand. So now, back again to this stream of words. You see how the stream of words which goes through our mind in the ordinary way is tied up with the sense impressions. This is why seeking sense impressions is a mistake. Wallowing in or running after sense pleasures is the mistake. The pleasures of the senses will inevitably come. You see a beautiful person, a handsome man, a beautiful woman, see a lovely sunset, the perfume of a flower or anything, a little child walking along or smiling at you. This is all a source of pleasure, of deep pleasure. Pure joy, and its purity depends upon the fact that you don't grab it or want to possess it or want to repeat it and so forth. You experience it fully and let it go. You completely let it go. So that's freedom. Now consider another aspect of the word. With very rare exceptions, perhaps barely a dozen or so, all words represent the limited, the finite, the particular, the mortal. Whatsoever is finite begins, proceeds, comes to an end. Certain things seem as if they'll never come to an end. We talk about the eternal hills, or still better, the eternal stars, but they are not eternal. By the end of the last century, it was thought that the chemical atoms of which the universe was made, you know, the different metals we know and the non-metals and so forth, that they were the eternal stuff of the universe. An atom could not be broken up, it could not be divided, and so forth, and it would persist forever. Permanence. We soon discovered even that isn't quite true. So now, the word represents that which is mortal. It begins, it is born, it ends, it dies. And this goes on endlessly. And the stream of words is the stream of samsara. Essentially, the stream of samsara is the stream of words. The stream of thought, as we call it, discursive thought merely. The stream of endless births and deaths, as we call it, is the stream of words in our own mind whilst we are alive, from the time this body is born till the time it dies. When it dies, that stream of words has utterly gone, completely gone. As far as this organism is concerned. And this stream of mortality, as we have seen so far, is mainly made up of the sense impressions which have been sought and desired, the pleasures, and the other sense impressions, the fear and the pain and the frustration, because of our aversion from the unpleasurable situations. That is what it is made up of. Perhaps now we begin to see why the Buddha in particular talked so continuously and insistently about the sense pleasures and all sense delights. Don't think for a moment that the great teachers were at all insensitive to natural beauty. Far from it. They were the most sensitive of all to the real beauty that lies at the heart of everything. They were most sensitive to it. And the whole of their teaching was such that if one lived it, one would wake up completely to this marvelous beauty and happiness and loveliness which there is everywhere. But not this sensual, desirous, grasping, conflict-producing thing which we experience in our lives out of our ignorance. one has to be very wide awake and judge for oneself what one will do throughout the day in relation to this question of pleasure. So now, if this aspect of our lives has really come to peace within oneself, then meditation in the real sense can begin. In the real sense. Notice carefully, all the great religious disciplines, certainly the esoteric aspects of them, in the old days, when it was in certain ways circumstantially a little bit easier, all these disciplines start with freeing oneself from the search for sense pleasures. They all start there. And when that is reasonably firm, the simple moralities, the purity of everyday life, has a good chance of really flowering out. So that one is naturally, spontaneously pure and simple. And in that state of purity and simplicity, it is possible to realize quietude, inner quietude, inner peace. Because what is the meditation concerned with? It's not concerned with learning the doctrine at all. It's not concerned with the acquisition of any sort of knowledge in our worldly sense of the word knowledge. Absolutely not. It is concerned with the freeing of the mind from any sort of verbal activity. And note that verbal activity means all sensuous activity. It is the ending of that. The sensuous activity in the organism named man is the most powerful divider of the separator of the individual from the totality. We have seen that already, how it raises up the whole conflict. Wanting the pleasurable, fighting against the unpleasurable. You see? So, the quietening down of the stream of words means that the state of disturbance is over. Then you are, to use a commoner garden phrase, in heaven, in the state of peace, the state of bliss. The state of bliss which is not a merely passive or static condition, far from it. One has to enter it. And if you enter it, and you get to the stage where you can enter it as you wish, when you wish, I'm using the word wish, but you'll understand it is not grasping desire. You see, you enter it, then you know this is the fact, this is the truth. The stream of words has stopped. Now, if the stream of words has stopped, and the word, and every word, as I say, with rare exceptions, barely a dozen or so, in any language, represents the mortal, in what manner are you conscious? In the mode of mortality anymore? Or in the mode of immortality? When the Buddha, after the enlightenment, goes to the five who practiced the disciplines with him, and they failed. When he became enlightened and he went to them to speak to them, what were the first words he said? "Hearken, bhikkhus, the deathless has been found." Now you see, even those of us who take the trouble, because we are serious enough about it, actually to read the original texts, what do we do in the ordinary way? We read this, we get a nice, exciting sensation. Oh, the Buddha said the deathless has been found. Right, I'll go for it, hell for leather, and find the deathless. We never pause to savor, to digest, to assimilate, and to bring to psycho-spiritual fulfillment the real significance of those words, "the deathless has been found." Because bear in mind that this man, Siddhartha Gautama, who said these words, died just exactly like anybody else dies, and as you and I will inevitably die. Thank the Lord. Think of these miseries who live to 896. With everybody else's teeth and hair and skin and heart and lungs and kidneys, and still have the absurdity to sign the name with which they were born. Now, the deathless has been found. What is this deathlessness? The freedom from the tyranny of the stream of thoughts and words which represent the whole of the sense life with its conflicts. This is the state of living immortally. There is no other meaning to immortality, or any other meaning that one may find is only another form of this or an extension of this. This is immortality. If you really see this, you will find that an enormous amount of tribulation within oneself, longing for immortality, longing for enlightenment, longing for liberation and all that nonsense will disappear. And if you really see this and understand it, you will cease to struggle to attain the stopping of the flow of words. Look, the flow will stop by itself. This does not mean that the mind will be a complete blank. Far from it. But it means something like this. What we commonly call, I'll use the first person, it's easier. What I commonly call my mind is a misnomer. There is no such thing as my mind. There is only this living organism, which, amongst other things, displays the phenomenon of the passage of thoughts and feelings. This passage of thoughts and feelings are verbalized. It's our speech faculty which is of extreme importance in our life. The brain goes on talking to represent a certain state of the organism in response to the stimuli, both those which come from outside and those which arise from within the body. You see? Now, there is no such thing then, really, as my mind. It is only convenient to use that phrase. If there was a thing like my mind, it might survive the death of the body as a separate thing, and it might also precede the existence of the body. But if you look into this matter very carefully, you will find that nothing of the sort happens. It's very difficult to see this because we have been conditioned through the millennia to think of soul, spirit, mind, and so forth as an immaterial something. Funny that we use the word thing in this connection. Different from the material body. And it has not been possible to be free of that illusion for the very simple reason that our knowledge of the material body, as we call it, was conditioned, completely conditioned by our ignorance of the true meaning of matter. How do we obtain our knowledge of matter in the first instance? Through the sense avenues. You take up a particle, as we say, or an object. We say it is solid, or it may be something liquid, like liquidy, like treacle or syrup. Then we say that it is a little bit sticky or of that sort. And if it is gaseous, well, we say it's a gas. And you can swear that it exists because you can blow like that and feel the pressure of that gas upon your hand and so forth. Our sense experiences made us form our conceptions of matter. Then when at last experimental science entered that field where it discovered through scientific apparatus that, say, what we call the green color of grass is no property of grass but only a rate of vibration, it began to rather shake our conceptions of matter which we held before. And in this century, when we have discovered and established firmly that this hard, material, impenetrable, which hurts when it strikes us, and all this is perfectly true in the sphere of sense impressions, because our body is what it is, when we began to discover that this hard thing has no substantiality at all to it, that all our ordinary qualifying terms which we apply to matter are untrue in actuality, you see, then what has happened to matter? It has become completely dematerialized. What has happened to the particle? When in actual fact we make our modern discoveries of what we call the intra-atomic particles, not by seeing them or hearing them, touching them, tasting them, or in any way experiencing them with our physical being, but we first of all discover them purely through mathematical analysis. Then we say that from this analysis it is clear that a particle, we still use the word particle, of such and such a nature ought to exist. Then we devise ways and means to find out how we can make it produce certain effects. We perform, as we commonly say, certain experiments. And we predict that if these experiments are performed, and if what we say about those particles and their existence is true, such and such effects ought to be visible on the photographic screen or whatever it is. And when we do see those effects, then we say, yes, that particle exists. But try and catch it. It's a will-o'-the-wisp. Some of them exist only for a millionth of a second. Catch it. Has it got a head? Has it got a tail? Has it got a body? Is it an it? A congeries of immaterial energies which momentarily produce an impression. Now, that basically is the nature of what we experience as hard, solid, impenetrable matter, and so forth. So you see, from ancient times, it was not possible for those people to do away with the division between matter and mind. It wasn't possible. Therefore, God was a spirit, here we were earthly, in earthly bodies, and so forth. But now the situation is different. Now look into this carefully and see that the stream of words is the prisoner of our sense experience, constituted as we are. So when the stream of words stops, there is mental activity going on. What is the nature of that activity? But it is not the activity of my mind. It is the activity of that which is universally present, the omnipresent, the unknown, the ungraspable, in any shape or form. It is the activity of that. It is the activity of that which in theistic terms we call the divine energy. We have called it the divine energy, the power of God, which in Hindu-Buddhist terms we name differently, as Brahman and Atma, or the Adi-Buddha, or the Dharmakaya, or whatever it is. We have given names like that, which should only be names. One should never try to arrive at a precise definition of these names, because we will invariably and inevitably give the wrong definition, because words represent the very reverse of this transcendent reality. But when the stream of words has stopped here, then through this organism there is the realizing by the one total reality of the meaning of immortality. And the holy ones have all affirmed that this is the utterly blissful, the utterly perfect. But it is a blissfulness and a perfection which has no relationship whatsoever to our conceptions of blissfulness and perfection. Because all our conceptions are limited and finite. They are mortal. They are the stuff of death, not the stuff of life. The conceptions will of course cease if the stream of words is at rest. Now, note carefully, there is an even more difficult and a profounder aspect to all this. The stream of words may stop absolutely, or it may not. And yet you will be in that transcendent state. As a pure onlooker, nothing else. But you are not looking at anything finite. That is to say, you will be looking at whatever you are looking at will be recognized and called the finite by the unawake, the unrealized person. So this passage through the mind, well, even I find it extremely difficult to try to put it, to say some words which suggest what it is like. This passage through the mind is a passage of the infinite, a movement of the infinite, which gives the impression of a finite, of the movement of finite particulars to the unawakened. It is a complete paradox, isn't it? But this is the fact. As the Tibetans put it, the mind is in its natural state. With the absolute stopping of the stream of words, there is the void in the real sense. With this non-absolute stopping of the stream of words, there is the plenitude. There is neither void nor plenitude in the supreme state. Because these words for us are finite particulars. But you know, here and now, it is possible, I'm going to use the ordinary common or garden phrase, it is possible to know this. But it is possible to know this as and when the organism which bears our particular name has really seen sufficiently deeply to become free of any sort of attachment and any sort of aversion, to be free of the state of conflict within, as we commonly say. Now, when the freedom from any conflict takes place within, as we ordinarily say, it has also taken place in relation of this particular within to the total without. The internal and the external, whatever the external may be, are in complete harmony. Look, is not this one of the profound meanings of Jesus? Peace be still, he said to the waves. The disciples who had not attained this inward freedom and peace were all storm-tossed. But the perfected Holy One was not storm dust.
You see?
So whatever the external condition is, peace is restored as far as you yourself are concerned. Peace is present and harmony is there. But it depends basically upon purity, on purity. And the essential meaning of that purity is freedom from grasping for pleasure and trying to push out displeasure. That is its root. So you see what is involved in this stream of words. There are so many things that derive from seeing this. But I won't try to go into that, otherwise we'll be talking till tomorrow morning. There is so much. But try and understand this fully. Because it is basic to realization. This is the state of communion. And the stream of words is at peace. It is the meaning of the enlightened state. It is the entry into the kingdom of heaven. It is the realizing of nirvana, the blowing out, the extinction of all that greed and hate and delusion which is associated with the conflicting state. It is the meaning of so many of the great affirmations through all the scriptures. And Enoch walked with God, and Enoch was not, for God took him. Get it? What it means? Elijah went up to heaven in a chariot of fire. A whirlwind took him up and separated him and Elisha. Elijah and Elisha, in one sense, in a very profound sense, represent two faces of one being. The name Elijah, Eliyah, means God Himself. And the name Elisha means God the Savior. Both of them are no other than God. When you read that second book of Kings, it's one of the most tremendous things in the whole of the Old Testament, how Elijah and Elisha go together and find out from a concordance the meanings of the words, of the names of the towns, Gilgal, circle of samsara, of mortality, of the duals which are not in harmony. They go out of that. Jericho. Jericho means the place of fragrance. You'll find the same thing in the Kaushitaki Upanishad. You arrive at the place of fragrance in the journey of the soul. And they come to the Jordan. And the Jordan represents the parting of the ways. See, one goes through the different states, the deep states of consciousness, which are still associated with sensation. And when you come to the parting of the ways, then forever and ever there is either the ascent into the eternal, or there is the remaining behind, but not behind in a derogatory sense, the remaining behind in the world of things and affairs. And Elijah goes up to heaven by a whirlwind. It's like a whirlwind. In this chariot of fire, God himself in his own place, heaven, Elijah. And Elisha, the savior aspect, he is the teacher, the helper of those who are on earth. It is the one being who has realized both aspects of himself. The one which in profound meditation can enter into that transcendent realization, and the other aspect which in the world of men teaches and helps and so on. And you notice how both of them perform similar miracles. Just like Jesus raising from the dead and that kind of thing. So now, the stream of words and the pleasures of the senses, that has been our topic for today. Brood over it. Take it to heart. Really take it to heart. It will transform your life, you know. This is the peak of all yoga. The joining. The restoration to the ultimate real. It is the samadhi. And in that realization, and through that realization, you yourself all your life are a benediction upon your brother man.